There is a morning I want you to picture. September 1929. Long Island, New York. Mitchell Field. The air is thick and damp. Visibility is low. The kind of morning most pilots in that era looked at through the window, shook their heads, and stayed on the ground. Jimmy Doolittle did not stay on the ground. You know Jimmy Doolittle. Maybe you know him from the Tokyo raid in 1942. Maybe you know him as the first man to complete an outside loop. But I want to tell you about a different Doolittle. The 32-year-old Army Air Corps lieutenant who climbed into a biplane that morning pulled a canvas hood over his cockpit until he could not see the sky and proceeded to take off, fly a full circuit, and land, using instruments alone, and in doing so made every IFR flight you have ever flown possible. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, this one matters. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com now. 1929. Let's put you inside aviation at that moment. The Wright brothers had flown just 26 years earlier. Commercial aviation was struggling to its feet. Airlines were beginning to carry passengers. The airmail routes were running. But weather was killing pilots at an alarming rate, and I don't mean that loosely. The airmail service alone lost dozens of pilots in its early years, many of them to weather, and the thing that weather does to a pilot who loses sight of the horizon. Between 1926 and 1929, weather-related accidents accounted for a staggering percentage of the fatal crash reports coming across the desks of aviation administrators. The industry knew it was a problem. The problem was, nobody knew how to solve it, because here's what happens when a pilot flies into clouds with no instruments to trust. The human body cannot tell you which way is up inside a cloud. Not reliably. Not under the forces of flight. Your vestibular system, the fluid in your ears that gives you your sense of balance and rotation, is designed for walking around on the ground. It was not designed for coordinated turns at 100 miles an hour. It will tell you that you are wings level when you're in a 30-degree bank. It will tell you that you're pulling up when you're level. And it will absolutely convince you, with every signal your nervous system can muster, that what the instruments say is wrong. Pilots called it flying by the seat of your pants. That phrase gets used romantically. What it actually meant was, if you lost sight of the ground, you had maybe 60 seconds before spatial disorientation dropped you into an uncontrolled spiral you could not recognize and could not recover from. They called it the graveyard spiral. We still call it that. Because it still happens, because the human body has not changed. So here was the problem in 1929. Aviation was growing. Commerce needed aviation to be reliable. The airmail needed to fly in darkness and weather. The fledgling airlines could not build viable businesses around clear skies only, and pilots were dying because the instruments to navigate clouds either did not exist or did not work well enough to trust with your life. Enter a man named Daniel Guggenheim. If you know the Guggenheim name, you probably know it from museums. His family made an enormous fortune in the mining and smelting business, and they spent a remarkable portion of that fortune on causes they believed in. Daniel Guggenheim believed aviation was the future of transportation. He also believed that aviation's future depended entirely on making it safe and reliable in all weather. In 1926, he established the Daniel Guggenheim Fund for the promotion of aeronautics with $2.5 million of his own money. That would be somewhere north of $45 million today. With that money, he funded university aeronautics programs. He supported research into weather forecasting for aviation, including some of the earliest systematic weather reporting networks designed specifically for flight operations. And in 1928, he established the Full Flight Laboratory at Mitchell Field on Long Island. The mission was specific: solve instrument flying, design the instruments, prove the procedures, and demonstrate that a pilot with the right tools could fly safely in zero visibility. To lead the flying side of that program, he brought in a pilot. Jimmy Doolittle, by 1928, was already a name everyone in aviation knew. He had won the Schneider Trophy seaplane race in 1925 at an average speed of 232 miles per hour. Flying a Curtiss R3C2 racer low over the water at Baltimore. He had performed aerobatics that most pilots of the era would not attempt. And here's the part people forget. He had a doctorate in aeronautical engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, earned in 1925. His doctoral dissertation was on the relationship between acceleration forces and the disorientation of pilot experiences in flight. He had been thinking scientifically about the physiology of flight for years before Guggenheim called him. Doolittle understood the problem from both ends. He knew what the human body did in the clouds, and he understood what the instruments would need to do to overcome it. He threw himself into the work at Mitchell Field with the same focused intensity he brought to everything else. He worked closely with the Sperry Gyroscope Company, which had been developing gyroscopic instruments for ships and aircraft for decades. Lawrence Sperry, one of the pioneers in gyroscopic stabilization, had died in a crash over the English Channel in 1923. But his work continued, and Elmer Sperry Jr. was at the leading edge of a new generation of gyroscopic instruments designed specifically for the cockpit. What the Sperry team had built and what Doolittle helped refine and prove was the artificial horizon. Picture a small instrument on your panel. Inside it is a gyroscope spinning at high speed, mounted on gimbals so that no matter what the airplane does, the gyro stays aligned with the actual horizon of the Earth. A small symbolic aircraft on the face of the instrument shows you your attitude. Nose up, nose down, banked left, banked right. The instrument does not care what your inner ear says. It does not care what the clouds look like. It tells you what is actually happening to the airplane. Alongside the artificial horizon came the directional gyro, which gave a pilot a steady heading reference that didn't precess and wander the way a magnetic compass does in turbulence and turns. Anyone who has ever tried to read a compass in a bumpy descent knows that it is essentially useless in dynamic flight conditions. The directional gyro solved that. You set it to your magnetic heading on the ground, and it held that reference with a precision that made navigation in the blind actually possible. They had a sensitive altimeter, they had a rate of climb indicator, and they had a radio navigation system, a network of ground-based radio range beacons that transmitted a four-legged pattern of Morse code signals. In the solid portions of the signal between the legs, the signals overlapped into a steady tone. A pilot with a radio receiver could use that steady tone to track inbound to the beacon and know with real confidence where he was in space relative to the ground. None of these instruments were entirely new on the day Doolittle flew, but nobody had put them all together. Nobody had designed a cockpit and a procedure around them. And crucially, nobody had proven that a pilot, using only these instruments with absolutely no outside visual reference from takeoff to landing, could do it safely. That proof was the mission, and September 24, 1929 was the day they ran the test. The aircraft was a consolidated NY-2 Husky, a biplane. Open framework, fabric covered, two cockpits in tandem. It was a Navy trainer, reliable and honest, but nothing exotic. Doolittle had selected it partly for that honesty. If something went wrong in this experiment, it was not going to be because the airplane had a surprise for him. The front cockpit was fitted with a canvas hood. When that hood was raised, the pilot could see nothing outside the aircraft. The instrument panel. Yes. The stick and throttle and rudder pedals. Yes. But the sky, the horizon, the wingtips, the runway, nothing. Total black in the rear cockpit, sat Lieutenant Ben Kelsey, an Army pilot serving as safety observer. His job was to keep his eyes outside, watch for other aircraft, and take the controls only if Doolittle was about to kill them both. Kelsey did not touch the controls, not once during the flight. He would later say it was the most nerve-wracking thing he ever witnessed. That is saying something for a man who went on to test some of the most dangerous experimental aircraft of the following decade. Doolittle pulled the hood up. The world disappeared. Now I want you to sit with that for a moment, because the sensory experience of that cockpit matters to understanding what he did. He could still feel the engine vibration through the airframe. He could smell the exhaust and the oil and the damp September air coming around the edges of the hood. He could feel the grass of the field through the landing gear when he taxied out. All of that was present, but the sky was gone. He taxied to the end of the runway using the directional gyro to hold his heading. He pushed the throttle forward. The consolidated Husky began to roll. He held the gyro centered. He felt the tail come up. He kept the artificial horizon level, and at some point, without seeing anything outside that cockpit, the vibration of the wheels on the turf simply stopped. He was airborne. He climbed to 1,000 feet on the altimeter. He made his turns on the directional gyro, watching the rate of turn indicator to keep the bank controlled. He tracked the radio range beacon to stay oriented over the field. He flew a circuit roughly 15 miles in length. And then he set up his approach. He descended on the altimeter. He tracked the beacon inbound. He kept the wings level on the artificial horizon, and at some point the vibration of the wheels on the grass returned. He was down the whole flight. From the moment the wheels left the ground to the moment they touched back down took roughly 10 minutes. Ben Kelsey in the rear cockpit did not say anything for a moment. Then he said something close to, "That was one hell of a thing." It was. The newspapers covered it. The Army received the briefing. The Guggenheim Fund published detailed reports, and the aviation world began to understand that the weather barrier, which had been as real and as deadly as any mountain range, had been broken, not by luck, not by bravado, by engineering and discipline. What I want to make sure you take away from this story is the line that runs from that grass strip at Mitchell Field to every instrument approach you have ever flown, the artificial horizon in your panel. The heading indicator, the ILS localizer and glide slope, the VOR and the GPS approach, the idea that a pilot can accept a clearance into instrument meteorological conditions and be expected to emerge from those clouds at a specific position, a specific altitude, lined up with a specific runway. All of it traces back to what Doolittle proved on September 24, 1929. These are not incremental improvements on the way things had always been done. They are answers to a specific engineering problem that a specific group of people set out to solve with serious money and serious talent. What Doolittle demonstrated was not just that the instruments worked, he demonstrated that a pilot could trust them enough to override every instinct in his body. That was the harder proof. And that is the thing every instrument pilot learns on their first real flight in the actual clouds. The moment when you decide to believe the instruments and ignore the lies your inner ear is telling you. That decision, that act of trust, is what Doolittle made possible. He went on to larger stages. The Tokyo Raid, the 8th Air Force, 4 stars, a career that any 10 pilots combined could not match. But if you ask me what his most consequential hour was, I will not point you to the Norden bombsite or the long-range escort mission or any of it. I will point you to a September morning in 1929 and a canvas hood pulled over a biplane cockpit on a Long Island grass strip. Because every time a pilot breaks out of the clouds and finds the runway exactly where the instrument said it would be, that is Jimmy Doolittle's gift. He had to prove it was possible before anyone else could do it. He had to go first. He went first. Most of what I drew on today comes from Doolittle's autobiography, I Could Never Be So Lucky Again, and research from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum on the Full Flight Laboratory, worth reading. Both of them more at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Trust your instruments.